Hello and good day. It's August 25th, somehow, 2021. This is episode number 554. That's 554 of the Apple Context Machine. That's a podcast for the Mac Observer. I'm Brian Chaffin, the artist. To get the full story on anything we cover in this podcast, you can visit macobserver.com/ACM. And if you'd like to comment on or question anything about the show, you're welcome to shoot me a note over at macobserver.com/contextmachine. That'll take you straight to the Facebook group for this show. Now, joining me today in the very hot seat is a guy who, if you are a regular and avid reader of TMO and a consumer of Daily Observations, you've heard a lot from him over the past week and a half. It's Jeff Gamet. Jeff.
Brian. It's awesome to hang out with you.
Yeah, thanks, man. It's been good good hanging out with you for the last you've been helping out while Charlotte was vacationing.
Right. And she has very big metaphorical shoes to fill.
Indeed.
Charlotte and I have actually hung out together and in London.
I've only hung out with her in San Jose.
Oh, well, hanging out with her in London was a wonderful treat. And I can definitively say that while she has metaphorically large shoes, she has literal small shoes.
Yeah, that is very fair. I'm hoping to hang out with her in London if the Delta, Epsilon, or Gamma variant of COVID-19 allows. We're working on doing a bucket list trip for my mom in England sometime next spring.
That would be so cool. Yeah. I genuinely loved London and shot up to Cambridge and hung out there for a little bit. And anyhow, just everywhere that I went in the UK was an absolute treat for me.
I forget. Are you an Anglophile?
No, I file all my nails.
Are you an Anglophile?
No.
I see. I am. So if you enjoyed it, I'm sure that I will enjoy it even more. Although I don't know, I'm kind of a jerk. So
it truly was a wonderful experience, and it was great getting to experience their public transportation system.
Mm.
Wonderfully efficient, and yet I've talked to so many people from there that complain about it. And I just keep telling them, you have no idea how good you have it.
I am so sure.
You know, and Brian, I'm actually worried that when I said I'm not an Anglophile, that people are going to misinterpret that. Because I loved everyone I met. I love the culture over there, and I do love
Of course, yes. Stuff. But there's an Anglophile is someone who is like particularly obsessed with the English culture or history and such. And, you know, there can be files for any particular culture. Not being an Anglophile does not mean that you don't like England or the English.
Right. I just wanted to make that clear because I'd hate for someone to think that I think that the UK and England and although the fun cultural things are that I think those are crap, because that's not true.
Excellent. Glad that we got that cleared up for anyone who may have been misinterpreting our earlier part of the conversation. Let's see here. I should mention that HelloFresh is sponsoring this particular episode. Later, I'm going to tell you how to get up to 14 free meals from HelloFresh, including free shipping, but got to hang on for that. Let's see. We have two topics today that I personally am very interested in. The first one is going to be it's very, very Apple-centric. What we are hoping Apple actually announces this fall.
Wait, so we're on Apple Context Machine.
Yeah.
And we're going to talk about something Apple-centric.
Yes, but we're also going to talk about something that's not Apple-centric.
It's just so weird. The world's topsy-turvy, talking Apple stuff on an Apple show.
Yeah, but also, again, anyway.
Anyway.
What do you think? What should we be expecting Apple to announce this fall? New iPhones, duh.
Right, yes. A new iPhone, of course. A new Apple Watch. And I would say, of course, but the Apple Watch doesn't necessarily have to be on an annual upgrade cycle because it's a watch.
Well, it has been heretofore.
Right. But it's not a requirement in the same sense that a new iPhone every year is.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, that's an interesting... Let's derail there.
Sweet. Off the tracks, right out the chute.
5 minutes out after the show. It's interesting. Like, I have gotten each new Apple Watch, and part of it is so that part of it's because I could. Mm-hmm. I was in a position where I could. And then part of it is because I need to be able to talk about these things and write about these things. Mm-hmm. Let's pretend that I write a whole lot anymore, but certainly to be able to talk about these things and edit for these things at the Mac Observer. But it is to your point, and maybe, golly, maybe this is just because I'm clearly thinking out loud and doing a terrible job of it.
Don't let that stop you.
I never have before. Watches have historically been something that you kept for years. In the case of timepieces, like, you know, mechanical watches, you would certainly keep them for years. And in fact, many of them become family heirlooms. They often gain value, if not usually gain value, as the years wind on. See what I did there?
Yes. I well done.
Swatch and Fossil both, I think, made watches so inexpensive and so style-centric that they turned them into something that you may well have many of with a low budget. Clearly, there are rich folks who have lots and lots of mechanical timepieces. Mm-hmm. That's one thing. But ordinary folks, a lot of ordinary folks, might have, back in the day, might have had a bunch of different swatches, or maybe even multiple Fossil watches, which do tend to be a little bit more expensive. I think they're even owned by the same company, but don't hold me to that. There's been so much consolidation in the watch world in the past couple of decades. It's hard to keep track of it sometime, but you know, they're very much fashion pieces. And in fact, sometimes you might put your Swatch or, you know, one of your Fossils in a dresser drawer and then forget about it. That's probably been a fairly common occurrence for lots of people.
Right. And then years later, you find it and it's a surprise.
But with, right. And then you throw it away. Like, I mean, you shouldn't throw it away. It's still probably a perfectly good watch that should be, you know, passed on to someone else in some way. But that's not the point. With Apple Watch, Apple makes it, you don't have more than one watch, really, right? You've got a watch that's tied to your phone and that's tied to all your data. Mm-hmm. And instead, you might have multiple straps so that you can change the appearance of your watch, but it's pretty much the one watch. And yet, mm-hmm. despite the fact that they last longer than a year, Apple does release new ones every year. It is an interesting thing, and you know, and today Apple is one of the largest, if not the largest, watchmaker in the world by dollars and volume.
It's kind of crazy, but there you go. Yeah, you know, Apple has done a great job of making Apple Watch integral to our whole daily routine, but also making it a fashion thing. Hence, with watch bands. But when I said Apple doesn't have to release a new watch every year, even though they have. I think that's true. They don't have to. Other smartwatch makers that, I mean, they have different release cycles, and in some cases, instead of releasing new versions of a watch, they just kill a model and roll out a new one.
Yeah, they're throwing spaghetti at the wall, hoping that something will stick.
Right. And what Apple's doing is each time they give us a new watch model, they're giving us new features. They're enhancing it in some way, which is great. And they're definitely staying ahead of their competition, which good for them. But still, I mean, the whole watch cycle, refresh cycle, I don't think it has to be an annual thing. That's just how it's working out right now.
Well, it Whereas certainly doesn't phones, have to be an annual thing for does. Users.
Right. Yeah, it doesn't have to be an annual thing for users. Yeah.
It probably does for Apple. It probably does need to be annual for Apple in order to keep the interest up and whatnot. But there's no reason. There's no reason for people to do what I do, which is to buy a new one every year, unless there's some particular new feature that they just have to have. But like, you know, one thing that's interesting about Apple Watch is, for instance, for people who have timepieces, I'm talking about expensive mechanical watches. It, you know, one timepiece person might look at another timepiece person and go, "Oh, what are you wearing today? Oh, you've got your Omega, or you know, you've got your Longines." And that, or maybe even the particular model, right?
That's exactly how watch owners talk.
Exactly. And, but no, it's like, oh, I'm wearing my 3 series today. Like no one who has the current, what is the current one? 5?
6, I think.
Is it the 6?
I don't know.
I don't even know. Current Apple Watch. It's ridiculous.
No, this is awesome because it reminds me that some things never change.
Correct. but like anyone who has a Series 6 is not going to choose to wear their Series 5, you know, re-choose that in the Apple Watch app. Or like maybe they have a black Series 5 and a stainless steel Series 6. They're just going to wear their Series 6.
Right, but they will swap out the bands.
But they might swap those out.
Yeah, but that's, in a manner of speaking, like the high-end watch collectors who do the, "Oh, which watch are you wearing today?" thing. With Apple Watch bands,
you can be also, like, "Hey." Exactly what they actually sound like.
Yeah, well, I studied... do you remember when you took me into that watch shop? I think it was in Vegas.
Yeah, this is a true story.
This is a true story. Yeah. And we walked in and, man, they treat you nice when you go into a fancy watch shop.
They treat you nice when you go into a fancy watch shop when you have a fancy watch on your wrist.
Right. And that was you, but I'm with you. And so they're treating me real nice. And I finally told the guy, "Look, I'm not here to buy. This is Brian's thing, and I'm just enjoying watching." And he still treated me really well, as if I were buying a fancy watch. I just thought that was really cool that I didn't suddenly become invisible when I straight up told him I'm not buying anything.
Yeah, that is all fair. All fair. All fair. It is.
But he never was like, "Oh, Brian, you must see this watch. It winds backwards." Just, you know, something like that. I think the tendons just popped straight out of my neck doing that.
That's great. So it is interesting to me that there is, like, I think we buy phones for the new features. Right. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, we're buying it for the camera, we're buying it for the processor, we're buying it for the display. It's probably those three things.
We're not buying it for the processor. We're buying it for the camera.
So,
I think that's
camera into display. I'll accept your correction, but camera into the display.
Yeah, most people have no idea what processor's in their iPhone, and they don't care.
You're right. I think I was sort of transposing, like, the M1 iPad Pro.
Okay, now see, that's a different story, because that's actually a big thing for a lot of people.
Yeah, that was something I got for the processor. So with Macs, we're generally speaking buying for the processor and the display,
mm-hmm.
right? And so, yeah, sometimes memory, sometimes storage, but, you know, it's that processor and it's the display that's usually getting us to buy a new Mac, you know, faster and or better. And with Apple Watch, yeah, there might be some new hardware related feature in it, but it is a different buying cycle experience with Apple Watch.
Yeah. With my Apple Watch purchases, I was buying every model every year up until, oh crap, what do I have? We're on the 6 right now.
Yeah.
Okay, so I have a 5.
Okay.
And I didn't buy the 6 because I didn't feel compelled to add in the new features to my wrist.
Yeah. And that is entirely fair. And it's one of the reasons why I was like, you know, people, it's worth revisiting the original Apple Watch that was mm-hmm. in gold. It was like, what, it was 10 grand, wasn't it?
It was crazy expensive. Yeah, it was something like that.
And a lot of people, especially when Apple didn't renew that, didn't like do an updated version of that, a lot of people called it a failure. And I always argued at the time that the purpose of the gold watch was not to sell. The purpose of the gold watch was to position this device as a fashion accessory as opposed to a piece of technology. And that from that perspective, it succeeded fabulously well.
Right? I have to agree with you on that. Yeah.
The Apple Watch, the gold Apple Watch, what was that called? Is that Apple Watch Edition? What did we call Apple? What was the gold?
I think it was Apple Watch Arrogant.
Gold Apple Watch.
What was that you called? You know, they didn't need to sell. I think it was Edition, but you're right. They didn't. They actually didn't need to sell any of those. They just needed to manufacture enough so that they could give them to key people.
It wasn't even giving them to key people. It was also having them be visible in select retail environments.
Right. Yes, it became an exclusive thing. You had to go to specific stores to see that gold watch.
And yeah, the people who went to those stores
for what it was supposed to be.
The people who did go to those stores anyway saw the watch there. But it was never like it was. Because it was still a technology device, it always had a limited shelf life. Right? The battery at some point is going to be toast. Yes, you could replace the battery, but the processor is also going to become slow. Now, this is much different than gold mechanical watches, or for that matter, even gold quartz watches.
And I'd be pedantic on you for just a moment.
Of course. Please.
Oh,
always.
God, I get to be pedantic on you. Okay. So you said that the Apple Watch, because it's technology, it's different. And I think it's more accurate to say the Apple Watch is different because of the type of technology it is. The technology that goes into a mechanical watch is crazy amazing, but it's also a technology that by its nature has a longevity that the technology in an Apple Watch does not have.
Yeah, that I completely agreed. Because for one thing, mechanical movements are improved probably every year. Not necessarily. Like there are some movements that may be sold for decades that do not get improved, but new movements are being invented all the time that do new things or do things differently. But the old movement doesn't stop working or become incapable of supporting new issues of Time. Whereas there's lots of software that the original Apple Watch Edition, which I think is in fact what it was called, does not do or support.
Yeah, that's absolutely true.
It does still support new units of Time that are released every moment.
Does it support Swatch Time?
I don't think so.
Well, then why do we even bother?
Yeah, it's a fair point. So it is the Apple Watch definitely occupies, I think, a different space in our life for those who use it that from other Apple devices. And it's been an interesting path. Now this
I don't even remember our topic segment.
It's what we're expecting Apple to release this fall.
Oh, right. Well, since you just brought us back on topic, I'll pull us off again. I looked it up finally. Apple Watch Edition priced between $10,000 and $17,000.
Oh, that's right.
On. Yeah.
Yeah, I forgot that it did have that higher price too. And then when, you know, John Keat bought the Apple Watch Edition that was ceramic.
Oh, I remember that. Yeah.
And I thought those were super cool. I was bummed when Apple didn't do. I got Apple not doing another gold one. The gold one did its job, and it was time to retire it. Mm-hmm. And again, I reject anyone who says that the gold one was a failure. It was not. It was a fabulous success, and did everything that it was supposed to do. Matter of fact, I will add to that Apple successfully hoodwinked lots of high end watch stores into being its mechanism for becoming a fashion accessory. Because I imagine that most of those watch stores did not make a profit on selling Apple Watches, the gold ones.
Probably not. But I'm with you. The Apple Watch Edition Gold was a success in context of what its goal was.
Yeah, what the actual goal was. And selling units was never its goal, in my opinion. I have no evidence. I have no, like, you know, whispers out of Apple. I have no, you know, leaked emails or conversations that I've heard about. Nothing like that. It is simply understanding. It is my, what I consider to be an educated opinion, understanding the watch industry, and then watching and listening to everything that Apple was saying about watches at that time. And then also watching and seeing how the conversation changed outside of, like, the Apple world when talking about Apple Watch and talking about smartwatches in general. It just totally, totally rewrote the rules. Totally rewrote the rules.
That's so Apple.
It is so Apple, in fact. All right. So I'm really hoping that Apple releases some kind of M-based 27 or probably larger inch iMac. I'd love it if it was the M2. I don't think it'll be the M2. We keep getting stories and leaks coming out of the semiconductor industry about an M1X.
Yeah. Okay, let's talk about that for a second.
Okay.
As long as we're here.
That's the supposedly the topic of the segment, but go ahead.
Yeah. Okay. I'll roll with anything. I mean, tracks, who needs tracks? So M1X, to me, that seems very plausible. But whatever Apple calls it, it's totally arbitrary. I mean, they could come up with a new name. They could call it the M2 or the M1 Pro. It doesn't matter. Don't get your panties in a bunch. The reason I think that they would go with a name like M1X this time, I think, is because, and total speculation on my part, no insider information, I think that what the processor is going to be is the M1 with maybe some minor enhancements on it, but more importantly, additional IO buses, because that's a key thing that's missing from the M1 right now. And if you want to have full data throughput on more ports than you can have right now, then you need more IO on there, because you're basically at the one IO channel.
Yeah, right. But Apple would be breaking all kinds of rules in a very bad way if it took the M1, added some IO buses, maybe some more memory, and then called it the M2. They can't do that, because they'll be taken to task by anyone saying this isn't the M2, it's just an M1, you know, the beefed up M1.
Hence the M1X name.
Right. So, but you said that they could call it whatever they want. I disagree.
They can, but there's repercussions depending on what they call it.
Yeah, unnecessary repercussions.
Naming is arbitrary. I mean, they could call the new chip the Apple Chicken, and people would be like, WTF. But it wouldn't change what the chip is. It's just an arbitrary name. But yeah, I'm going with M1X. More IO channels on it. Probably a graphics bump in the chip, and higher processor and bus speeds.
Fair enough. And I need a new iMac. Okay, I guess I don't really need a new iMac. Probably just fine with my current iMac, but I would like an new processor.
Are you really okay with your current iMac? I mean, it doesn't have an M series processor.
That's my concern. That's my concern is being left behind. That hasn't been an issue so far, but I don't want to be left behind.
All right. Well, then I'll make you even more concerned about being left behind. I think you got the screen size wrong. I think that the next iMac that Apple releases with this beefed up processor, they're going to go bigger than 27 inch for the display.
Oh, I said that. I said whatever they end up replacing it with.
Yeah, but you did toss the word 27 in
there. Right. So what I meant was the space at the current 27 inch. Cherry
pick what you say and throw it back in your face.
All right. I mean,
isn't that how it works?
That's how it's when I'm doing it. Yeah. So I guess you get to do it too. I learned
it from watching you, man.
So the space that the current 27 inch occupies, I also believe will be replaced by something like a, you know, 29, maybe even a 30 inch. Mm-hmm. And that's what I'm hoping is the case. And I am pretty. I don't know if it'll be a 5K or a 6K display. Any thoughts there?
That's a tough one. I think it ultimately depends on what parts availability they've had. And I use past tense because we're at the point now where whatever it is that Apple's going to release this fall, it's pretty much nailed down.
So it's being already decided if it's going to be announced in the fall, it's being manufactured in at some point.
Right. So they decided, I'm betting, between 5K and 6K on display availability. I'm being totally pragmatic there, which is probably what they've had to be with some of their design decisions.
Right. Right. And I want for Apple to announce the 27-inch iMac. Mm-hmm. I'm not actually sure that Apple will. I don't know that it's ready yet. We haven't had the kinds of rumors that we often get from Apple's supply chain, the leaks, I should say, that indicate a new product is coming for that particular model. Now, that said, the iMac has been something that often has Apple has sometimes been able to produce in the States, where they're able to keep a better control over potential leaks.
Yeah, good point. Yeah, if they're doing something U.S. specific, meaning for production, then we may not see any leaks.
Did we get leaks on the 24-inch, the one that was announced earlier this year?
I don't remember now.
I think
we
that
did on the laptops that came out.
Yeah.
But I don't remember on the iMac.
I don't remember either. Anyway, I'm hoping that Apple's going to replace the 27-inch iMac. That's the better way to put it. This year, this fall, I am not 100% confident that it will. I am confident that new iPhones are coming out. I am confident that a new Apple Watch is coming out. Would not surprise me to see some further iterations on Apple's laptop line, maybe the rumored replacement for some M processor based Mac Pros, larger Mac Pros.
I don't think the new Mac Pro's coming this fall.
Why?
We don't have the right processor for it yet.
Well, if we don't have the right processor for that, we probably don't have the right processor for the 27-inch iMac either.
I will lovingly disagree with you on that. I think this this rumored M1X would be just fine for the bigger screen iMac. I think what Apple needs for the Mac Pro will be whatever the M2.
Sorry, did I say Mac Pro? I meant MacBook Pro.
Okay, well, now we're talking a totally different thing, and I'm completely
confused. Yeah, I was super confused. Did I say Mac Pro?
Yes.
Okay. I'm not going to go to the tape because I don't want to find out just how wrong I was. But I did mean the MacBook Pro. I completely agree. I don't think the Mac Pro is going to be bumped yet. We may even get some kind of additional Intel-based Mac Pro unit, maybe.
Well, we already got the crazy video card upgrade option.
Yeah.
So, and so that told me that the M series Mac Pro is not this year.
Yeah, yes, I agree with that. And by the way, I really hope, I don't know that Apple will do it, but I really hope that Apple releases some kind of M processor based add-on for the Mac Pro that will allow those things to run M processor software.
So that's an interesting idea, and I really like it. But I'm wondering, would it be an M series daughter card from the Intel Macs, or would it be an Intel daughter card for the M series Macs?
Well, what I want to see is the people who spent lots of money on Intel based Mac Pros being supported with and not pooped on with an M based, okay. I don't even know if daughter cards are. What's the box thing that they do? You could get was it the Nitro box, right?
Mac? Oh yeah. For the video.
Yeah, that right. Architecture, it seems to me, could support, it seems to me, I say that without having much of a technical background to back that up. Yeah,
don't let that stop you.
Yeah, exactly. But it seems to me that architecture could support some kind of M-based add-on, even if it was $2,000 or $4,000 or something like that, that would allow people who spent $15,000, $17,000, $20,000, $25,000 on a Mac Pro, keep them going and be able to support M-based software too.
I love that idea. Which makes more business sense for Apple? And I'm not tossing this out with the answer in mind. I'm just tossing this out there. Does it make more sense to, from a business standpoint for Apple, to have a new Mac where you can add in Intel support? Or does it make more sense from the business perspective to sell a new M1 Mac and an M1 daughter card that you can put into an Intel Mac?
from a dollars and cents standpoint, it makes no sense whatsoever to take the time and effort to develop any kind of M-based processor for the few thousands of machines that Apple sold to Mac Pros for people who might upgrade. From a dollars and cents standpoint, that makes no sense. From a not pooping on your customer standpoint, it makes a lot of sense.
Okay, I'm totally with you there.
And from the, especially in, and again, my good friend John Keat talks about this a lot. The idea that the people who buy the high-end machines have an outsized influence on the rest of the world, supporting those folks has, to me, utility value that exceeds the financial value of you know, however many millions. And it would literally, I think, only be millions, maybe tens of millions, but probably millions lost on developing and selling a product like that. Because millions, Apple losing millions to satisfy high-end buyers, high-end users. Like, and by high-end user, I'm talking about people who need real power. Those folks have an outsized influence, and keeping them happy makes sense to me.
So what I'm hearing is M1 Mac and Intel daughter card. So I'm totally being flippant there, but at the same time, these high-end users are they by and large the people that are buying a high-end Mac and then holding on to it for a long time, or are they the people that rotate through these computers relatively quickly compared to other Mac users?
Oh, because come on, man.
They need the latest and greatest for their job.
No, yes, both. Because you know, graphic designers. How long would graphic designers, when you were in the world of printing, how long would graphic designers keep a hold of their systems that they were using to do their work?
It depended, and I will elaborate. So if they were working at an agency, the agency was probably leasing the equipment and rotating it out every 18 to 24 months so that they did have the latest and greatest, giving them a leg up on the competition. If they were smaller agencies or if they were freelancers, they were probably buying equipment and holding on to it for too long.
And the same thing is true in the music production business. Studios would buy, set up, you know, dial in their systems and then keep those systems running for as long as they possibly could because they didn't want to change anything, which was often the case for a lot of high-end graphic designers too. They didn't want to change anything. It's not that they didn't want more power or were satisfied with what they had, but God forbid they actually have to go through the process of making something new work the way they got their old system working.
Yes, I remember encountering that at agencies. Yep.
And then
when I told them that the CRT that they were using was changing color over time, then I broke so many hearts saying,
oh,
that.
I bet. God, well, that's really going back to the day. And the same thing I think is true with architects. I think the same thing is true with a lot of heavy data crunchers as well. I mean, surely there are some Mac Pro consumers who would, you know, buy a new machine, you know, spend another $20,000 on a new machine, you know, whenever there was something that's new released. I don't really think that's the case, though. I don't think it's the case in large numbers. I think a lot of folks are holding on to those, especially when they've spent a ton of money on them and want to get as much use as they can out of them. You know, I don't know. Listeners, please fill me in.
Yes. Listeners, please fill Brian in.
Okay. So that's topic one, and we are 2/3 of the way through the show. So.
Oh, wow. And we didn't even get into other potential products, but okay.
That's no, fine. We didn't. We, yeah, hardly. Yeah. That's a, anyway. So hold on. Let me take a second and tell you about HelloFresh. With HelloFresh, you get fresh, pre-measured ingredients and mouth-watering seasonal recipes delivered right to your door. You can skip trips to the grocery store and count on HelloFresh to make home cooking easy, fun, and affordable. That's why it's America's number one meal kit. HelloFresh offers 50 menu and market items to choose from every week, from vegetarian meals and calorie-smart choices to extra special gourmet options. There's something for everyone to enjoy with recipes designed and tested by professional chefs and nutritional experts to ensure deliciousness and simplicity. Get better value. HelloFresh is over 30% cheaper than shopping at grocery stores, with pre-portioned ingredients that ensure you won't spend money on excess food that ends up going in the trash. That's very important to me. And also, the fall harvest is officially on with HelloFresh. You can count on seasonal recipes like pumpkin cinnamon rolls and Friendsgiving-ready sides, as well as fresh, high-quality ingredients that travel from the farm to your front door in less than a week. Now, all of those things are very important. I got to tell you, what I love about HelloFresh is getting everything I need to make a meal and exactly what I need with step-by-step instructions. Everything is very plain to understand, very easy to understand. It's got easy to understand pictures. It has easy to understand written instructions. These recipes are easy to follow, and I have loved the meals that I made. And it's something I very much encourage you to check out. Now, because you're a listener of ACM, go to HelloFresh.com/ACM14 and use code ACM14 for up to 14 free meals. And that includes free shipping. So one more time, go to HelloFresh.com/ACM14 and use code ACM14 for up to 14 free meals. And that includes free shipping. This is good stuff. You should absolutely and positively check them out. And I appreciate them for sponsoring this week's episode of the Apple Context Machine. Okay, Jeff, let us look at topic two. Topic two is this one's probably a little more important to me than to you. I don't know if you have much interest in this, but hear me out. One, we're going into cryptocurrencies, folks. If you saw the title of the show, you already know that.
I haven't seen the title of the show.
You haven't, but more than likely someone listening to the show has.
It's very possible.
Okay. So here's the thing. A lot of folks there are some folks who look at cryptocurrencies and say they don't do anything. They're not solving any problems. They're not, I mean, like they have no use other than to facilitate criminal activities or ransomware or, you know, money laundering, things like that. And
there
are people who say that. And there's a case to be made for that. However, I believe that that case is an erroneous case from the standpoint of so-called next generation cryptos, some of which are here, some of which are partially here, and many of which are still being developed, let alone what comes after what's already in the works. So what I'm talking about are blockchain-based cryptocurrencies that are trying to solve real-world problems. For instance, by the way, full disclosure, I do own small amounts of many of these cryptocurrencies. If I'm a fan of it, there's a chance that I own some. It's not the sort of thing that has ever influenced what I say. I'm not encouraging you, dear listener, to buy cryptocurrencies. I would also add, and I tell this to anyone who asks, if you're going to be putting money into a cryptocurrency, make sure it's money that you're comfortable losing, because that could happen. And in no way am I offering any investment advice. I'm talking about the technology today. And let's look at like Polkadot and Chainlink. These are two different cryptocurrencies that are designed to solve, to facilitate some real world solutions. They're both capable of allowing different blockchains to talk to each other, to interoperate. And
so,
yes.
So you're saying it's a cryptocurrency but it's also a conduit for different cryptocurrencies to talk to each other.
Different blockchains to talk to each other.
Different blockchains to talk to each other.
Yes. And also to allow blockchains and the traditional financial systems to be able to talk to each other, which is potentially huge. Then there are my very favorite cryptocurrency is Cardano, the unit of which is called the ADA for Ada Lovelace, or ADA for Ada Lovelace, depending on how you want to pronounce her name. The Cardano is
ADA.
I think it actually is ADA. I'm going to cough a second. And Cardano is very, very next generation in a lot of different ways. Smart contracts are coming. It has on-blockchain governance that is really important. You can do some on-blockchain.
So what does that mean? On-chain governance.
On-blockchain governance is the people who own Cardano control it. And they vote on changes. And all of that, there's like an actual voting system that is built into the blockchain.
So they can like upgrade the money with new features.
Yeah, well, yeah, blockchain can be updated too. But the people that control that voting process are the miners. So the miners being the people that own the physical hardware that is checking the encryption levels for blockchain transactions. And because the miners are controlling it, they tend to want to do things that are in the best interests of miners, including not making changes that might make that might devalue their investment. It's one of the big problems with Bitcoin. And I do own some Bitcoin. With Cardano is a proof of stake cryptocurrency, meaning that the privilege of checking the encryption, verifying the encryption to keep the network secure, is done on computers where people have pledged their Cardano for that right. And they're also the people who would vote on changes to the blockchain, meaning that the people who own it are making those decisions. They're the ones who are doing that voting. And that mechanism is built into the blockchain itself. You actually use your wallet partially to do voting on the Cardano blockchain.
So that, in a manner of speaking, is putting your money where your mouth is.
Yes. And which to me is great. It's part of the whole decentralized concept, where it's not a bank that's controlling something. It's not a central bank that's controlling something. In the case of Cardano, it is the people who own the Cardano who are doing the controlling. Now, a lot of that Cardano is in the hands of some of its creators, but there is a lot of Cardano that is not in the hands of its creators. So there you go on that. Smart contracts are basically ways of having some kind of an agreement in place that is on the open ledger of a blockchain, which is what a blockchain is. It's an open ledger where the terms of the contract, when they are fulfilled, the contract gets automatically executed. The easiest way I have of explaining that, and this is such a minor and trivial kind of smart contract, but you and I, Jeff, could make a bet on a game, assuming that access to scores was, you know, there were APIs for accessing scores. We could have
the latest Richmond game.
Yes, the latest Richmond game. I do see what you did there. We made it about Apple. But you and I could bet on the results of a basketball game or a football game or a baseball game. And when the game takes place and the scores are posted, the winner is automatically paid and no one can welch or, you know, not pay or do anything like that. That's a smart contract in its simplest form.
Okay.
So there's a lot more that smart contracts can do. a lot more important things that smart contracts can do. And each blockchain that supports smart contracts is doing it in different ways. Ethereum already supports smart contracts, but there's a whole lot of issues with Ethereum sorry, that's probably a deeper conversation for another time. Now, so let's move on to what brought this whole thing to mind, which is Fetch.ai.
That was an amazing intro to get to this point.
Fetch.ai is a newish cryptocurrency that is, amongst other things, enabling software agents that operate on the Fetch blockchain, and to be fair and to make it more complicated, Fetch runs on top of Ethereum, but does have its own separate Fetch blockchain that's its own thing, because that's one of the things Ethereum allows. I know I just made it really complicated for people. But anyway, Fetch is building a blockchain where software agents can act autonomously, negotiate with each other, and essentially make decisions. And so, yes.
Okay, so to make sure I understand this right, we're talking about software. We're talking about applications.
Yes.
And we're calling them software agents because they have some level of autonomy.
Yes.
So if I was using my cryptocurrency to buy and sell stocks, then I could tell my piece of software, here are the thresholds for buy and sell. And then it could just execute everything for me.
Right, which is what hedge funds do currently.
Mm-hmm.
But when hedge funds do it, they're doing it in ways that you and I cannot. Right? There's a name for this, and it's suddenly escaping me. They'll buy server space in the same data centers that host the various exchanges.
And the closer your server is physically to theirs, the bigger advantage you have, because the electrons don't have to travel as far.
Essentially, that is correct. And so they're able to make a profit by seeing and automatically transacting in certain stocks based on the activity around that stock. And so let's say that I put in my order on E-Trade for, 10 shares of Apple. Right. And to be honest, the hedge funds don't really care what I'm doing, but let's just pretend. And the hedge funds see that happening. They could turn around and buy the shares of Apple at one price and then sell it at a slightly higher price to the incoming order. Now, it's possible that I know just enough about how this kind of trading works. I forget what the name of it is to get myself in trouble. But the idea of having a server that sits in a data center with the exchanges and conducting transactions in literally tiny fractions of a second before the rest of us can do those transactions and then profiting on the back and forth, that is something that hedge funds do. And it's something that you have to have a lot of money to be able to do.
I would assume so.
With software agents on a blockchain, it's actually possible that could be slightly democratized.
But that would be interesting.
Because a software agent could be designed to buy certain shares when it sees a deal somewhere. For instance, that could be you could program a software agent to do a lot of different things. And depending on what it has access to, it could possibly compete with those hedge funds, completely eliminating that particular advantage for these folks. I'm using, trying not to use profanity here. That is one type of software agent that can be done. But another, like, I have been waiting for software agents, Jeff, for more than 20 years. When I first read about them in either the late 90s or early 2000s, I forget which. But I do correspond it to the early days of TMO, which, you know, we did launch in December 28th, 1998. So somewhere in that time frame, either right before or right after, I was reading about software agents that could do things like go find me all the articles about a certain topic, maybe from a particular publication, maybe by a particular person, or maybe with a particular set of keywords in those articles, and then send those to me so I don't have to go find them. Right? I've been waiting for this for decades. Like, where are my software agents? Where's my hover bike or my hoverboard, or where's my flying car? Where's my software agents? Well, with Fetch.ai, we might be close to actually having software agents that can actually do something. And that's very exciting to me. And it's potentially real world problems that could be solved by this cryptocurrency / blockchain.
Okay, so I have a question for you now.
Yeah.
Because what you just presented to me is very intriguing. You know, the ability to use these applications, these software agents, to go and do the research to find the data that I'm looking for. So if I wanted to do that in this hypothetical situation, do I then just go, say, to the App Store and buy the kind of application that I need that can do those searches? Well, or do I have to go through an agent, like a data agent, to find that information for me? I mean, how would that work?
So to be clear, and I, by the way, full disclosure, I bought the token for Fetch.ai is called FET, F-E-T. I did buy some FET, just for complete disclosure.
Please tell me that fractions of a FET are a boba.
I don't think they are. Although that's
a missed opportunity.
Is it? Maybe.
Yeah, it really is.
So I don't know how one would end up accessing these agents yet. I don't know enough about it. For one thing, the software agents are still to come on this crypto, right? It could end up being vaporware, right? That's absolutely and positively a possibility. The market cap for Fetch.ai is, let me see if I actually see, do I see what the total, like it's at like 300, it's less than $400 million. It's not a big crypto by any stretch of the imagination, which means it's in its early days. Well, there are lots and lots of cryptos that are worth where the market cap of that crypto is in excess of $1 billion. And as a point of comparison, Bitcoin's current market cap is $918 billion. It has been over $1 trillion, retreated quite a bit. There was a big dip in the crypto world over the last few months, and it's been rising again. It's back up to $918 billion. There are a whole bunch of cryptos that are worth more. Yeah, $423 million is the current market cap for Fetch. So it's relatively small. So I don't know yet exactly how you would access them, but here's how my understanding of how it would work. If I wrote a software agent, for instance, that could detect the price of gold and enact a purchase, and you turned around and said, "I want to buy some." So I've done all the hard work of writing this software agent, and then someone else has a software agent that is designed to arrange. And by the way, I'm just like, I'm literally picking these examples out of thin air. Someone else has a software.
It's great. I'm actually watching you through the glass reach up and pull them out of the sky.
Just pull them out of, let's call it the sky. And and someone else has written a software agent that is capable of looking for shipping price deals, like dips in shipping prices, because sometimes there are like fluctuations in shipping prices, right? And then someone else has some kind of agent that is capable of, I don't even know how this would work, of package, you know, of like finding someone that will package my gold for it and get it and ship it for me. Again, these are not great examples. And then those three agents end up working together to make my gold order happen. Well, I put my order out on the Fetch network and I paid some Fetch to make that happen. Each owner of the software agents that made my order happen will end up getting some FET as a reward for making that happen. And maybe okay. Someone else has, maybe there's 1,000 different shipping software agents that are all working together. Or let's do something that's not real world shipping. A software agent that is capable of watching airline prices. And I say, I want a ticket on this day at this time on this airline if it reaches such and such a price. And now that software agent is just going to be monitoring those prices. And then as I've put that order out there, and this in the first software agent that successfully says, hey, I've got that for you, right, and can facilitate that airline ticket purchase, that software agent would end up getting rewarded for some of the FET that I paid for my order in the first place.
Okay.
So that's the incentive for people to design the software agents. And the thing is that the software agents will be able to act autonomously, negotiate with each other, and then act accordingly. And that is super exciting to me.
That is cool. Okay, so while I'm thinking about this, I'm thinking about all the amazing things that we can let the technology do for us. And it sounds cool. And at the same time, I'm thinking, okay, where are the places where people are going to abuse this? And one of those places is the cost. So if you have these agents, these software agents, they're getting a commission off of the transactions.
In essence, they're getting a fee. Let's call it a fee.
They get a fee. So that assumes that if I, as someone requesting whatever it is, some sort of transaction, some sort of data search, that I can afford to do that. So are we creating a new barrier to data access that cuts out people that can't afford to perform data searches? I mean, as it stands right now, if I don't have a computer or a smartphone, I am cut out from that, except that I can go, say, to the public library and perform data searches.
Yeah, that divide already exists.
Is this going to make that divide worse?
I think it's going to make the divide less worse. Or what's that word that people use?
Better.
Better. That's the word. I think it could make that divide better by giving the power of speed and technical prowess to more people, maybe not to everyone, but everyone doesn't already have access, or not everyone has access today.
Right.
Right. Yes, so for instance, like look at LexisNexis, right? The ability to pay for a LexisNexis subscription for decades gave some people access to information. Now, maybe it might be for the good from the standpoint of journalistic organizations. Access the kinds of information that you and I simply couldn't get because we couldn't do a LexisNexis search. LexisNexis is an organization, you probably heard about them because they have long supported public radio and public TV.
Also, their name rhymes.
And their name rhymes, right? What they do is they gather information. Like, you know, they were Google long before Google. They gather information and then they sell access to that information. And you could do LexisNexis searches. For instance, I could try to find an article about, I could try to find information about a particular person or about a particular day in history or about a particular location. I could do, you know, you could do any kind of search like that that you wanted. And it cost a lot of money. And then Google came along and, you know, making us the product, Google has allowed plenty of people to be able to do searches. It's still not probably a LexisNexis search, and in some ways it might even be better than a LexisNexis search.
It only costs your soul.
It only costs your soul. And but you do still have to have, you know, not everyone has the ability to access Google. For instance, if you're in China, you can't access Google at all, but you do have to have some kind of computing device, preferably with a display. So the divides already exist. I think that software agents could, not necessarily will, but I think they could and may even be likely to better the information divide. Maybe.
Okay.
So it remains to be seen. It also remains to be seen if they even work.
I have another like bad potential use.
Okay.
That I'd love your perspective on. Okay. What would prevent me what would prevent a jerk from creating their own software agent so that every time you do a transaction that involves whatever it is that I control, could be data, it could be maybe I do product delivery. Mm-hmm. What would stop me from setting up my own software agents that act as an in-between agent that all they're really doing is passing the transaction on?
Yeah, like becoming a software agent middleman and not actually doing anything?
Yes, becoming a software agent middleman. So you're just skimming money out of the whole transaction and
it would be up to the rest of the developer community to make their own agent smart enough to not use that kind of agent. And their incentive would be that they want their agents to be the ones that are actually doing the successful negotiations and decision making.
Okay.
So I think we're actually pretty protected. We're pretty protected from that.
Maybe.
Yeah, there will probably be people that figure out paperware at this point. Right. Right. And if history is any guide, there are people who will find loopholes and exploitative things that they can do on this new blockchain. Like, you know, did you catch the news that there was a hacker who stole $610 million worth of Polygon tokens? Did you catch that at all?
Yes, that sounds very familiar.
Yeah, he gave it back.
That's why it sounds familiar. That's when I heard about the story. Yep.
And you know, that was I don't know this person or group of persons' story. I don't know why they did it. I don't know even how they did it. But some kind of exploit was found and acted upon. This happens just like it happens with the internet, and just like it happens with our iPhones and our Android devices and our Macs and our Windows devices and even our Linux devices. I say even and our Linux devices, right? I mean, you know, exploits are found and there will certainly be people that find some ways to exploit the fetch network, although they're supposed to be using machine learning to increase their own security. I mean, well, you know, that show me. We get to be skeptical until they actually show it.
Right.
But yes, but the overall network should adjust to cut malicious actors or bad actors out.
I would like to think so.
Same thing. Yeah. By the way, there's some cryptos that do that are designed for file storage. Right. So, in other words, I could store all my data not on my Mac, but across the entire blockchain for file, what's it called? File.coin, file. Let me get this. Filecoin. Yeah. Duh. Filecoin is one of these. There's another one too, and I can't remember its name. And that blockchain is designed to punish bad actors. You know, anyone.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. So that they cannot get the privilege of storing your data for a fee. You get paid. Like if I'm putting up storage on the Filecoin. I keep saying corn today. On the Filecoin network, I end up being compensated for doing so with file tokens, because you have to pay tokens to get your data stored in the first place. Some of those tokens end up going to the people who are actually providing the storage. And that storage is encrypted and it's spread out and it's, you know, it's designed to be both secure and robust too, right? And if you are not taking, like, you know, if you're putting crappy hard drives or if you're actually trying to steal data, that particular blockchain is designed to punish those actors and take away whatever kind of Filecoin they have put up as a collateral stake, meaning it cost you money to be a bad guy.
Okay, but that's good.
Yeah, and that's another real-world solution, a real-world problem that is being solved by a blockchain. These notions of having distributed file storage. These are all, by the way, these are all like steps towards my OmniNet concept in my novel.
By the way,
yeah,
your novel is really great. I really enjoyed it. Thank you for writing that.
That's kind of you. If you're an agent out there, please. If you're a literary agent.
Seriously, Brian wrote a really great story, and it needs to be picked up, and it needs movie options as well. All right, so I have a question about the data storage thing.
Yeah,
because apparently I'm totally fine just hopping off the rails through this entire discussion.
Same.
So if I decide I want to store my data distributed across the blockchain network so that it's I can access it from anywhere, and presumably I can verify, because it's stored through the blockchain system, that it has not been altered in any way, and I can keep it encrypted so I have more security, and this all sounds great. But now I'm reliant on these people that are developing these blockchain data storage networks to actually keep them running. And so if they decide, we're out, then is my data just gone?
These particular examples, if the entire blockchain for Filecoin went offline, yeah, your data would be gone. Kind of like if a cloud storage provider goes out of business.
Okay. What brought that to mind was the whole NFT thing that took off a few months ago, even though it's been around for a while. And there were shady characters, probably still are, in that space, where people are buying NFTs that and they're reliant on a specific server staying online and functioning, which ultimately is not going to be there. And in some cases, they're already gone. So people have been buying NFTs that their transaction.
Yeah, a blockchain is a gone. Much better way of doing NFTs. And there are NFTs. I forget what they're called. I only learned about them recently. There are these like 8-bit avatars that were created as NFTs. And some of them are now trading for, you know, tens of thousands of dollars. It was, there was a finite number of them and there can only be one, you know, a blockchain is a much better way of doing that because the risk is being spread out amongst the entire network. And the entire network has some community level of incentive to continue doing what it's doing. So, for instance, the Filecoin people, if all of the developers decided that they didn't want to do it anymore and walked away, other developers could step in and the network could continue to function regardless. And that's much different than a company. If a company goes bankrupt and goes under, they're gone.
Right, and oftentimes their data's gone with them.
Right. Oftentimes. Yeah, that certainly has happened.
And okay, we'll I want to hop back on the rails for a second.
Okay, we're out of time.
If you don't mind. Yeah, well, too late for that. So going back to the whole fetch thing. What I'm envisioning with this, and let me know if I'm wrong, this could turn into a system where I could set up all of these different things that I want happening automatically in my life, and it could range from things that are happening on a personal level up to a business level, investment, whatever, and I could just set up all these agents and have all of these things happening automatically for me all the time. And the time that I would otherwise spend doing the research to figure out what I want to do or putting the list together of what I want to buy, I could just have all this happening automatically for me. And stuff just happens. I don't have to think about it anymore.
Yeah.
Am I envisioning this right?
Correct. That's why I'm so excited about software agents. And imagine if like, I mean, honestly, it's hard to actually see this, but imagine if Apple built in hooks for Fetch or, you know, some other software agent based blockchain into Siri or into HomeKit so that we could turn around and say, you know, hey, S lady, get me tickets to London when they hit such and such price. And now so I've got software agents working for me. As opposed to if you could buy tickets right now on Siri, which to my knowledge you can't. Do you know differently?
I believe you are correct.
Okay, but if you could, it would be because, say, Expedia has a hook that will fit into that'll work with Siri. And Siri basically is sending a command to Expedia, and then Expedia basically gives you the tickets that it wants to give you. That is a world of difference from a software agent looking for the best deal for you.
That is a lot different. Okay, so here's one scenario. I know we're out of time, but whatever.
We're like an hour and 20 minutes.
Oh, sweet. We're way over time. Go us. We're overachievers today. All right. So what I'm envisioning now is my car is due for an oil change, or the computer in the car gets a report that some component is failing or isn't working right. And now there's a software agent that knows what to do. So it goes and talks to the software agent for my calendaring and scheduling, and the software agent for my mechanics, the auto shop that I go to, figures everything out. And well, then I get a message saying, hey, Jeff, you're due for an oil change and a tire rotation. Your appointment is set for next Tuesday at 10 a.m.
Yes. Yes. Like, in other words, like that, I mean, we're talking about like really turning those home assistants, like Siri,
actual assistants,
and Alexa and Google Home, into actual decision-making assistants that are working in our best interest and not just doing what Apple or Amazon and Google want us to do.
Now, see, that to me is wonderfully exciting.
I am super excited by this. I hope that Fetch becomes a thing. And again, I did put a little money into Fetch. But I hope that Fetch becomes an actual thing.
Yeah, this would be really cool. And it needs to be a standardized system so that we don't have to use like five different Fetch and Fetch clones just to do all this.
Still, yeah. And
this is really cool.
People would have to be building ways for Fetch to work with them too. I mean, you know, this isn't like something that like sometime in October is going to like, you know, open up the world of software agents. I mean, there's a lot to take place. And maybe it's not Fetch. Maybe it's the thing that gets built inspired by Fetch. Right?
Yeah, but it has to start somewhere. And here we go.
It does have to start somewhere. And this to me is the promise of cryptocurrencies. It's not being able to send money anonymously, because that was never. I mean, I did think there was potential for that, but the more evidence that we have says that is never going to really be possible, because governments and central banks will find a way to shut it down if it ever becomes too much of a threat. Like, there's a certain level of pseudo anonymity and pseudo autonomy that governments and central banks are going to tolerate. But that's not the big thing about cryptos. The big thing about cryptos to me is much more along the lines of solving a lot of these real world problems. And software agents could go far in that.
All right.
Could go far.
I know it took us a long time to get to where we are in the show right now. Mm-hmm. But now
I've gone from...
I've gone from, okay, this is an interesting concept, and I can appreciate why you've been getting excited about it. But we've talked through enough of it that now I'm actually really getting it. And now I'm really excited with you.
Oh, good. Awesome. I wish I'd led with the idea of making Siri actually be what we want her to be. But I hadn't really put that together until we got there. So I appreciate you helping the two of us like sort of get to that point in the conversation.
It was a wonderful journey to take together.
It was. It was in fact. So all right, Jeff. Listen. So let me. I got. I do have another question for you. But let me play this first. And say that is this week's Apple Context Machine. If you have anything to add, comment on, question, you can write me at acm@macobserver.com. Our bandwidth is provided by CashFly, the bass is by Boom Recorded, just for TMO. And Jeff, tell us where, in addition to the stuff you've been writing and then recording for us for our YouTube channel, in addition to that, where can our listeners hear and read about you?
Well, how about if we send them over to Twitter and Instagram, or at J Gamut?
I like your Instagram feed a whole lot.
Oh, thank you.
Yep.
Thank you. Surprise to a lot of people. There's lots of flowers. And I do have a YouTube channel also. So if you go to youtube.com/JGamut, you can see even more videos.
Fantastic. Anything else you want to plug?
The show's been long enough today. I think that's enough plugging for right now.
All right, fair enough. In that case, I'll do this. Not you, Jeff. I love you.
I love you too.